I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about strategies for sustaining the state and the planet. We're going to talk about the Hoosier Environmental Council's work to green the State House and the future of agriculture. I'll be joined for the conversation by Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Laura Henderson of Growing Places Indy, and Jordan Sagar of the Indiana Department of Agriculture. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about greening the State House, really the future of agriculture and sustainability issues in general. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Kim Ferraro with the Hoosier Environmental Council. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks very much.
It's good to have you back.
I'm glad to be here.
Laura Henderson, who is with Growing Places Indy. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here as well. And Jordan Sagar, who is with the Indiana Department of Agriculture. Jordan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Kim, I'm going to start first by talk to me about what greening the State House is.
Sure, I'm happy to. This is our 6th annual Greening the State House, and it is HEC's really largest event of the year, where we mobilize folks who are concerned about environmental policy issues or environmental issues in general. And this year, our focus is on agriculture and sustainability. We typically bring together a bipartisan group of folks, policy people on both sides of the aisle in our legislators, so state legislators. We have various breakout sessions and panels, and all of them this year will be primarily focused on agriculture and sustainability issues.
What are the priorities that you're focused on in terms of greening the State House? And really the focus is on agriculture, certain attempts obviously to legislate as well.
Sure. We have honed in this year based on some very concerning policies that we saw being proposed in the State House last year relative to industrial livestock agriculture. There were 12 different bills that in one way or another were aimed at eliminating the ability of local governments and health departments from regulating large livestock facilities, undermining landowner rights, eliminating the ability of state regulators to protect the environment, food safety. And the most concerning of those bills was Senate Joint Resolution 7, which we understand will be back again this year, which would create a fundamental right, amend our Constitution to create a fundamental right to engage in the commercial production of meat, poultry, and dairy products. And that sounds benign, but unfortunately, by amending Article 1 of our state constitution, which is where our Bill of Rights are, think freedom of speech, think right to vote, enshrining a right to factory farm, essentially, in the state constitution would eliminate and make it very difficult for the state and local governments to enact new regulations or enforce existing ones, because existing ones would be subject to constitutional challenge because they were enacted under a lesser standard of constitutional muster, and newer regulations would have to meet a new higher burden in order to pass constitutional muster in order to limit to limit or regulate that newly created constitutional right.
Laura, we're going to talk more, obviously. I think we're going to have to talk about, I can't recall a time in my career as a journalist where actually agricultural issues at the state level have become quite as divisive or controversial as they have in the past couple of years. So I want to talk about that as well. But right now I'd like to talk generally about concepts of sustainability. Laura, could you tell me a little bit about, you know, what Growing Places Indy's approach is to creating sustainable lifestyles?
Yeah, I would love to. So we sort of encapsulate our work in the very short statement that we are working to empower individuals and through individuals' communities to grow well, eat well, live well, and be well. So when you think about sustainability, it isn't simply sustaining the status quo of where you are. The idea is improving so that in the future things are better. And so we're looking at our communities and saying that we have to be growing food well in ways that are in sync with the cycles of nature, that are respectful to the individuals, the environment, the animals involved, so that we can eat well. Because we are what we eat. And so it's not just the food we're putting into our bodies, but the energy of the systems that create that in order to be able to really live well, to develop, our cognitive abilities to their greatest capacity, our physical abilities to their greatest capacity, our ability to be compassionate and mutually caring of each other. And when we do those things, that's when we really open up this ability to truly be well. It's sort of, if you think of like life on a spectrum from life to death, you know, you're not either alive or dead. There's a wide range within that space where you can be really vibrant and living at your peak or sort of just getting by, surviving rather than thriving. So we are working to just start to get people more engaged in this. Really, relationships are what we see as being the soil or the ground in which you start to build awareness and an understanding of what sustainability means. It's kind of, we get caught up in this very abstract or detached idea of sustainability, like the long-term talk of sustainability, and we forget about paying attention to how we're sustaining ourselves as individuals, sustaining our own ability.
Jordan, from the Ag Department's perspective, how has this new focus on, you know, really how our food is produced, these issues of sustainability, changed the work that you have to do?
Mm-hmm. From the State Department of Agriculture standpoint, you know, we definitely welcome fair and balanced discussion on these agricultural topics. And as agricultural continues to change, we're going to need this lively conversation that takes into account a variety of different views. But I think it's, as mentioned, sustainability can be a pretty broad term. And I think to kind of hone in and help define it, we really see as sustainability as an operation, a process, procedure, practice that is economically viable, scientifically verified, and ethically grounded. And really see sustainability as this three-legged stool that you need all three of those components. And to expand a little further, you know, the economic viability is not just about money, but it's about all the consumable resources. And we want our system to be productive, efficient, and offer return on investment. In other words, we want these processes to be able to continue into the future. Absolutely. And to expand a little bit more on scientifically verified, we want our systems to be data-driven, repeatable, measurable, and specific. In terms of being ethically grounded, we want our systems to be compassionate, socially responsible, truthful, and respectful.
How long have you been with the Department of Agriculture?
I've been with the Department of Agriculture about 3.5 years, kind of moved around from the field, and now we're working out of Indianapolis.
Did you anticipate, I mean, you know, in this past session or two, we've had the commercial farming, you know, we had the huge controversy over the so-called ag gag bill. you probably did not think you were going to be marching into the middle of all of these hot button issues when you took the job, right?
My job today is solely focused on soil conservation, and I work exclusively with a team out in the field that works directly with private landowners to get conservation on the ground in a voluntary and proactive way. I don't get into a whole lot of the policy world.
Probably but, grateful for that, too. Right?
These issues are going on in other states, that's for certain. This isn't just going on in Indiana.
Well, Kim, could you talk with me a little bit? And I should invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Kim, where is this this coming from? It does seem like there is now a very concerted movement to try to preserve these I lack the language to describe the kind of operations we're talking about.
Yeah, I think I can help out. I think it's really important to understand the background of why we saw bills like Ag-Gag, why we're seeing a proposed constitutional amendment and many other bills aimed at, like I said, eliminating local control and state ability to regulate livestock operations. And here's why. I'll try to boil it down into a quick nutshell. 80% of the meat, poultry, and dairy products produced in the state of Indiana now are produced at very large, what are commonly referred to as confined animal feeding operations that confine thousands of hogs and pigs, tens of thousands of poultry birds, aside from the animal ethics issue about whether or not that's something that's a good idea, the waste produced by these confined animals are not handled very well and producing quite a few problems for our waterways, for people who live nearby with respect to odors, food concerns like overuse of antibiotics because animals are living under conditions where they need prophylactic antibiotics in order not to get sick, growth hormone use. There are all sorts of related issues to the way we are now producing farm animals that impact as Laura correctly pointed out, the food that we're putting into our bodies and the impacts on the workers and communities who live around these things. We are fifth in the nation for the most confined animal feeding operations. We have roughly 2,000 of them that are regulated, and I'm using air quotes because those are the ones that meet.
Yeah, thank you for telling people that because they really can't see it on the radio. But,
right. Yeah. To be regulated by the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, these facilities have to have above a certain number of confined animals. So, for example, 30,000 chickens would qualify as a confined animal feeding operation. But I get calls all the time from communities who are concerned just last week about a poultry operation that was opening with 28,000 birds. But that facility doesn't need a permit or approval, and so it is essentially unregulated. The point I'm going to bring this now to a close and let everybody else weigh in. These facilities, because they are ever increasing, are causing more and more problems with all of the things that I discussed. And so lawsuits are coming out of this. Policy initiatives to try to, curb the harm are we're seeing that. And this is really a push by a big ag interests to undermine the ability of folks to safeguard themselves and to push our state in a more positive direction.
I'm going to stay with you for just a second, Kim. Mm-hmm. Has it changed the, HEC has been around, Hoosier Environmental Council, has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Has this sort of explosion of activity changed the focus of the work that HEC has to do?
Absolutely. We are all hands on deck this year with respect to Senate Joint Resolution 7 because of the broad array of impacts that that amending our Constitution in that way would have.
We are talking about greening the State House, really the future of agriculture and issues of sustainability here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter. Laura, you wanted to...
Yeah. One of the things that you know, concerns me in this conversation is that as a consumer, we often don't know how the animal product or even the vegetables that we're eating, we don't know the system that produced them. We don't know, you know, the situation in which these products were grown and raised and brought to our tables. And so, you know, I think just there's a lot of talk about consumer choice and our right to know how we're feeding ourselves. What are we putting into our bodies? And so, you know, there's a lot of concerns related to the broader health implications that Kim's referring to, but also individually, just the right to be able to have choice and to, you know, I mean, these kinds of operations can be economically viable. They can be scientifically verified. And they can be argued to be very ethically grounded,
but they're not creating thriving
communities.
We'll catch this on the other side. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about greening the State House, the future of agriculture, really the issue of sustainability. My guests are Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Laura Henderson, who is with Growing Places Indy, and Jordan Sager, who is with the Indiana Department of Agriculture. Before we went to the break, Laura, we were talking about really the issue of consumers having a right to know and making informed choices that without the information, you know, what recommendations would you have, and I'll let anybody jump in on this one, for making sure that consumers have more information about the way that their food is grown and produced?
Well, as consumers, we need to take a more active role in asking questions. So, you know, for those who are able to go to a farmer's market, that's a great opportunity to engage in relationships with the folks who are raising the produce, raising the animal products there, and to ask them, you know, what's happening on their farms? What is it that makes them want to farm? What makes them want to bring that food to the consumer? And we try to offer our customers. Growing Places Indy operates the Indy Winter Farmers Market, which opens November 9th. We're open Saturdays 9 to 12:30 from November 9th through the end of April. And this year we're going to be working on some questions that are good questions to ask the farmers at the market. It helps you to learn more about what it is that you're eating and the systems that are producing it, as well as just to build relationships. When we know each other, we have more mutual respect.
Real quickly, where is the market?
Oh, thank you. Good question.
Yeah, so that people could go if they wanted.
Doesn't everyone know? The Indy Winter Farmers Market is located at 202 East Market Street. So we are in the west wing of the City Market building, which is now known as the Platform. Mm-hmm. So it's an indoor market. So it doesn't matter what the weather's like outside. You'll be nice and warm and have a wide variety of fresh produce straight through the season, as well as meats from non-CAFO farms.
And actually, we've gotten a couple of email questions that are sort of on point here. They come, and if you would like to send us an email, please do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. These questions come from Lisa, and one is from Lisa and the other is from Adam. They're similar in theme. Adam's is, what can be done at the state government level to give more support to small farm, like the kinds we see at farmers markets around the city? And then Lisa's is similar. It says, what is being done to encourage small sustainable farms? I would love to avoid factory farmed products, but farmers markets are prohibitively expensive for most middle and lower class consumers. Would the legislature consider any tax breaks or other price relief to make this good food accessible to the rest of us? Kim, go ahead.
Yeah, I just, before we leave the idea of the consumer right to know. Mm-hmm. And I do think this dovetails in with the two questions about what can you do. Mm-hmm. The ag gag bill would actually criminalize the videotapes or taking pictures of what goes on inside a factory farm. And so you hear a lot about the need to protect whistleblowers so that we can expose abuses. But actually what this is exposing is legal and common industry practices. For example, the egg industry will commonly throw male baby chicks into a dumpster and then grind them up alive or gas them because those chicks don't serve any sort of economic interest to the egg industry. Those are photographs that taken that get put out on the internet that as a consumer I would want to know about. I presume a lot of folks would want to know about that, but there's nothing illegal about it. And so AgGag is really about closing the door, closing the curtain to the public about really understanding the industrial nature, the commodity-based system where animals are truly abused in that system. And so fighting against bills like that is one thing that consumers need to do.
Yes, Laura.
I would like to address the question of cost of farmers markets. I have seen some interesting pieces that have been put together that pick out a selection of, say, 12 products that are available at a farmer's market and then compare the price of purchasing those at a large higher-end grocery store chain and a large lower-end grocery store chain. And it really depends on the product. There are a number of things that actually cost less at a farmer's market than they do at the low-end grocery store. So it's partly about learning, again, building those relationships that help you learn to use your dollars more wisely at a farmer's market. Also, you're getting more nutrient-dense food. You're actually going to need to have smaller meal portions in order to feel full and fulfilled and nourished better than if you're buying, you know, boxes of calories that don't have the nutrient density of fresh whole foods. What was the other part of that?
Well, really, it was also, are there things we could do
to support
small farms and presumption? I hope I'm not putting words into Adam and Lisa's mouths, but I thought that the spirit of the questions was, are there ways that we can level the playing field here?
The Farm Bill has some very essential grants programs that are up to potentially be cut. And so one thing people can do is call their representatives and ask them to advocate to keep those grant programs in the Farm Bill. And I don't know if Jordan might be able to say a little bit more about that.
Well, I was going to ask Jordan anyway, what do you see from the Ag Department's perspective? Mm-hmm. What is the biggest challenge confronting sustainable farming in Indiana right now?
Yeah, I guess, first off, John, the Indiana Department of Agriculture supports all types of ag production systems, big or small, as long as state and federal regulations are adhered to. The Department of Agriculture recognizes that a sustainable future includes local farms, organic farms, and conventional farms. And although we are seeing larger farms, these farms are operated by families. Just a quick statistic from a 2012 Atlantic article. There's a study done in 2010 where all the farms in the United States with at least $1 million in revenue were 88% family farms, and that accounted for 79% of the total production. To address some of what Lisa and Adam had asked, as far as what is the state doing in terms of local grown, we do have a program within the State Department of Agriculture called Indiana Grown. You can go search it on our website.
What is your website? What's the URL?
It's if you go ISDA.gov, Indiana State Department of Ag.gov, you'll find it there. Indiana Grown's the program, and it basically a label, a branding to help those local farmers promote their products to restaurants in those farmers markets, et cetera.
We are talking. Go ahead, Laura.
Well, I wanted to go just back to the cost and supporting farmers. We've initiated at the Indy Winter Farmers Market a SNAP, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, matching program. So not only is that helping folks who receive these SNAP benefits, often referred to as food stamp benefits, they can come in, they can get an extra $20 a week to shop at the market. So it allows their dollars to go further. It's also supporting our farmers and producers because there's more revenue passing through the market. And there's been a collaboration of efforts through the Indy Hunger Network to create a Fresh Bucks program that's supported by an Indiana State Department of Agriculture specialty crop block grant. It's a mouthful.
Yeah, don't try saying that one too fast.
That will support specifically purchasing Indiana-grown fruits and vegetables at farmers markets. So there are a lot of efforts to look at way, you know, really essentially what we see is supporting consumers and purchasing from small family farmers supports those small family farms and existing. And part of the problem we have in Indiana is that we've lost a lot of the infrastructure that we used to have to connect farms and consumers. So it's easier for folks who are in central Indiana, closer to Indianapolis, to tap into those direct consumer markets. It's harder for farmers who are outside of that area and are really surrounded by this industrial model of farming. You know, the future of agriculture is going to need to be polyfaced. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be one cookie cutter way to do it. And we need to be making sure that in our state policies, in our federal programs, you know, across the board, we're leaving space and building up the support for the small farmer to exist.
I could just jump in as well. I mean, I think it's really important to understand that a handful of very large national corporations like Cargill and Tyson and JBS actually vertically integrate with local growers on the ground. And so, A, there's sort of a lopsided bargaining power where the local, I believe Jordan said that we have locally owned CAFO farms, but they only have one market to sell to, and that's to the company that owns them, that also dictates the practices that they use and doesn't really pay a fair price for the product. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that for every worker at a CAFO, it replaces, the statistic I believe is 7 small sustainable farms. So we are the big corporation's making a lot of money, but that money is going outside of the local community. Whereas if a small farmer was there, the transportation system is creates local dollars, the market creates local dollars, the farmer gets a better price for his product. The whole rural local community benefits by having a local food system.
We are talking about Greening the State House, Future of Agriculture and Sustainability Issues here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Marion, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me again. I just want to thank you. This is an answer to a prayer to hear public dialogue about something. I'm a nurse. It's affecting all of us so much. I'm a nurse and health educator, and I advocate through Hoosiers for Healthy Animal Agriculture to ban confined animal feeding operations in Putman and Harrison County, and also keep a fall grass factory out of our local area. But we, I would like to say, and I thank Kim and Laura for all the work that they've done, but it's an oxymoron for our government to say, for agriculture to say, that they support all types of growing. We have an organic, I grow medicinal weeds and the things that the poisons and the fertilizers kill, and we farm, try to farm as organically as we possibly can, but because of the overspray and the Roundup that surrounds our little 7 acres, there's no way. I mean, I lost half my crop of stinging nettle last year because of overspray, and this year we can't eat our apples on the edge and all these things. So, you know, this is not true. They support, you know, and it's also an illusion, an oxymoron. These are not family farming. This is not farming. I mean, I grew up a farmer. I've lived with pigs. I've slaughtered pigs. I know. You know, this is not farming. My family farm has turned into a family business. So, yes, it's in the family, but we need to get back to a farming that goes with the laws of nature instead of against them. And that's enough. And what I'd like to ask Kim and everybody to please let us know what people, just common people locally on the ground, can do to keep up with all this massive legislation that's going on and how we can all help. Because I know last year with the gag laws, the whole amending of the Constitution kind of got lost. So And it made such a difference that so many of us were included. And thank you so much for speaking for my land and my animals. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Marion. Well, Kim, if people do want to get involved, how should they go about doing it?
Sure. Well, on the legislative front, the most critical thing that folks can do is contact their legislators and let them know that they are opposed to measures that would undermine the state's ability to protect us and our food system. It's a pretty easy thing to do. You can do it in two ways. One, get connected to the Hoosier Environmental Council. Go to hecweb.org. We always list all of the bills that were of concern and those that we're, you know, pushing on our website and how you can get involved. We have links to how you can look up your legislator, how you can contact your legislator. We have fact sheets. We have sample letters. We've got all sorts of resources for folks to use in reaching out to their legislators. The other piece, though, is, and I'll let Laura talk more about this, is to educate themselves on local food systems that are emerging in their area and participate in them to the extent that you can. You know, speak with your dollars, spend where you know where your food is coming from, find out who the farmers are in your local area, and we actually do have quite a few of them. They need our support in that way.
Laura, I think that's your cue.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of good news, despite what can often be very overwhelming doom and gloom sounding scenarios. And so what we're doing at Growing Places Indy is trying to really create these spaces where people can come together and build the relationships, the community, the food community, the understanding of what's happening in our local food system so that they do know how to plug in, they do know how to support. We offer classes, after school classes through the Chase Neary Side Legacy Center, as well as classes for adults in cooking, nutrition, gardening education. You know, and I think when you start to learn how to grow things for yourself, when you start to get back into the joys of cooking, that it really doesn't, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. It can take less time to prepare a fresh meal than to take something out of the freezer and then, you know, microwave it. I mean, it really can take not any more time, and it can be so much more satisfying. So, you know, getting involved in organizations like Slow Food Indy as well, you get to do tours of farms to see what's happening. And I think part of it is getting these stories out, getting our stories out, hearing from people whose health has been impacted by gluten allergy because we no longer have the diversity in the varieties of wheat, and how shifting their diet really changes their health. Hearing from farmers like Marion who are losing their crops, and there's no insurance to reimburse them for those crop losses, which are completely beyond their control. I mean, these, what she's talking about with the overspray is neighbors who are spraying chemical, you know, pesticides, fertilizers, these kinds of things on their crops, and the wind blows it onto her crops.
Drifts it over onto her land and her property.
And so, you know, and there's no recourse for her. She's essentially having her product destroyed by another farmer, and there's nothing she can do about it. That's just a loss.
Jordan.
And I'll say to Marion's issue there that the Office of the Indiana State Chemist regulates any type of chemical overspray, and there are regulations that these folks do need to look at wind drift before they're going out. And if these issues are occurring, I would highly suggest that the Indiana Office of the State Chemist.
Well, let me ask real quickly, are there penalties associated with that, though, or is it, is there?
There are enforcement measures in place, yes, under the Indiana Office of the State Chemist.
Okay, I see you saying yes, and I see Laura and Kim saying no. Kim?
They're minimal penalties, and unfortunately, because the Office of the State Chemist is fairly understaffed and under-resourced, and I would argue maybe even a lack of political will to take action against, you know, folks who are causing this problem. I get calls all the time where people who are suffering from this issue who have called the state chemist's office and have not received the help that they need.
We are talking about greening the State House, the future of agriculture, and sustainability issues here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-472-5787. 476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Laura Henderson with Growing Places Indy, and Jordan Sager, who is with the Indiana Department of Agriculture. You are listening to No Limits. I am John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about greening the statehouse, future of agriculture, and really sustainability issues. My guests are Kim Ferraro with the Hoosier Environmental Council, Laura Henderson with Growing Places Indy, and Jordan Sager, who is with the Indiana Department of Agriculture. Gotten an email question from a listener who doesn't want his name used. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Says that your current speaker, and I'm not sure which one it is woefully under or misinformed about the way food animals are raised. Anytime I hear the word hormones used in a discussion on food production, I think it may have been you, actually, Laura, my radar or BS meter goes off. Yes, medications are used in animal production. He says in parentheses, do we really want to eat meat from sick animals? But it makes no economic sense for producers to add expensive medications when they're not necessary. As for choice, the last time I looked in the grocery stores, there are choices to consume organically grown foods, just as there are choices to eat more affordable traditionally grown foods. The fact that food production has kept pace with technology and efficiencies, just as every other industry has over the past couple of centuries, is not necessarily cause for concern. The FDA and USDA do a great job of overseeing food production. We need to listen to science, not rhetoric. In a world with an ever-growing population and an ever-dwindling supply of natural resources, it makes sense to grow food as efficiently and as affordably as we can. Laura, I'm going to let you respond.
Well, I'm going to... I was not actually the one that referred to hormones, although I'm surprised I wasn't.
Okay.
And I'll let Kim fill in on that. But, healthy animals don't need added antibiotics to their feed. And the fact is that when you're raising animals, it's like when we've had situations in world history where too many people have been crammed into one place, they get sick. That's what happens. Before I turn it over to Kim, though, I do just want to say that I really hope that we can keep a conversation that isn't drawing a line in the sand between good and bad. These are not black and white issues. We forget that there's a whole rainbow of color in between. And when we start to say that this person is doing the wrong thing and this person is doing the right thing, there's no chance for us to connect and actually find solutions. So I want to encourage us to be solutions focused rather than problem focused.
Okay, Kim.
Great. Good. Very good point. I would point out to the individual who asked the question that the CDC just this last week came out with a finding that more than 80% of all antibiotics produced in the United States are given to livestock animals. And that the CDC recently made the link between our antibiotic resistance to the antibiotics that we're giving to livestock animals. So I do, we always look at science. That's very important to the Hoosier Environmental Council for us to be very fact-based and in deciding which policies we're going to be for and against. And I'll reiterate what Laura just said. When you cram thousands of animals together without access to fresh air and the ability to do what these animals do normally amid their own feces and waste, they're going to get disease. And so these antibiotics are given prophylactically so that the animals don't get sick. That is common knowledge.
Jordan, you were looking at me while Kim was talking.
Right. Just to add to that question from the caller, we really see welfare as two-pronged, both health and humane treatment. And sometimes that does include antibiotic use. And all animal products should be antibiotic-free when they go to market because of FDA, Food and Drug Administration, withdrawal periods.
We are talking about sustainability and greening the State House and the future of agriculture here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Or you can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Doug, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
This is just basically in reference to the Office of the State Chemist. I have worked in the green industry for 13 years around spraying fertilizers and weed control. And I have, I probably shouldn't say this, but I've never had the state chemist come see me. These guys out here flaunt all the time the rules of how they're supposed to be equipped, and the state chemist is so understaffed that it's, I mean, it just goes to the fact of them being able to keep track of the farmers over spraying.
In what ways do they flaunt the rules?
Well, you're supposed to wear, people are supposed to wear long pants, you're supposed to wear, you know, the correct footwear, you're supposed to have long sleeves, you're supposed to have gloves. I've seen guys out here in shorts and tank tops, and, you know, where easily you could see them from the road if you drove by. And it's almost to the fact that, and on top of that, I believe, if I'm not incorrect, I believe it's only like a $200 fine if you do get caught. So just the fact that, you know, they don't have the presence. And then I from what I understand, the repercussions are not that severe.
Thank you very much for the call, Doug. Laura, you were nodding your head.
I just was nodding in agreement. I would also like to go back to what Jordan was saying about health and humane use in response to animal treatment. And, you know, of course, none of us here are advocating for not taking care of sick animals. I think it's thinking about it the same way you think about antibiotic use for yourself, or even hormone use for yourself. You know, people, if you're really sick, there are times at which you need to take antibiotics. And we have also been told many, many times that it's not good to take them preventatively as kind of an ongoing regimen as part of our healthcare treatment, that builds resistance and actually makes us more susceptible to, you know, these growing super bugs and super bacteria. So I think, you know, why not apply the same logic to what we expect of the treatment of animals, to what we would expect for the treatment of our children and ourselves?
How large, Jordan, how large is the agriculture industry? How important is it to the state of Indiana? How much money are we talking about?
It's a large portion of the state. So about half the state, about 12 million acres actually, is in row crop production. And this would be the corn and soybeans that you see driving down the road. Actually, in 2011, over $37 billion went to Indiana's gross domestic product because of Indiana agriculture. We're in the top 10 states that export internationally. And here in Indiana, agriculture provides more than 475,000 jobs, totaling about 17% of Indiana's workforce.
Where I'm going with the second part of this, then, is how heavily staffed is the Department of Agriculture and the other regulatory agencies?
It's important to note that the Department of Agriculture, which I work for, is a non-regulatory agency.
Okay.
Those who regulate agriculture in Indiana, that falls to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, the Office of the Indiana State Chemist, and then Department of Natural Resources gets involved a little bit.
Okay. Kim, how... Yeah,
I just want to point out that the Indiana Department of Environmental Management really takes the lead with respect to regulation of confined animal feeding operations. Their regulations only govern, though, and I think it's really important to understand, only regulate the management of manure. It doesn't regulate odors. It doesn't regulate air emissions. It doesn't regulate land use issues with respect to odors and how close a facility can be next to a neighbor.
Who would regulate those things, or is there any regulation?
Well, local governments, which SJR 7 would eliminate the ability of local governments to do, which is really where so many of the community problems are coming in.
So your contention then is really SJR 7 is an attempt just to take this whole huge segment of the Indiana economy out from any sort of regulatory oversight.
Right. And going back to the question that you originally posed about the number of people involved in that, I think the last I checked, it was 11 staffers for the entire state and more than 2,000 regulated facilities.
Yes, Laura.
I love these statistics that Jordan gave us a moment ago, and thinking about 12 million acres in crop production now, I would be very curious to know how many of those acres are in commodity crop production and how many of those acres are producing food that can be directly consumed by people, not processed
into food. You probably,
for
people who don't do ag speak all the time, ought to explain the difference there.
So commodity crops would be things like corn, soy, grains that are being grown either for ethanol or for new kinds of compostable plastics and things like that, or grown for animal feed, versus vegetables and vegetables and even animal products that are being raised that can be directly, you know, they're whole foods that can be consumed by individuals. You could buy them and make a meal with them. I also, the statistic on $37 billion being what we brought in, we spend $90 billion a year importing food to the state of Indiana. So even a small shift in acres to vegetable production could, you know, that's a significant amount of that money that we could bring back into our local economy. And with 475,000 jobs, I believe it is, you know, I like to think how many more jobs we would have within our rural communities if we still had communities built around, you know, tool repair, seed saving, which you can't do now with Monsanto regulations and other large corporations patenting their seeds. And, you know, I mean, there's just all of these side businesses that came together to form the fabric, the strength, the economy of these and the soul of these rural communities that we don't have anymore. So, again, it's the spectrum of, you know, being alive and being dead. So the situation, you can argue, is pretty good in Indiana now. How much better could it be if we diversify and start thinking about what are the goals we have for our state, and how does agriculture play into achieving the vibrancy and vitality, the resiliency we want in our communities?
Jordan, I'm just going to ask you, at a personal level, I mean, with this kind of work, we heard Marion's call earlier where, you know, she was quite emotional, said, you know, my family farm, which she clearly has a profound, you know, personal attachment to, is being turned into a family business. And we've seen a lot of the issues that surround agriculture these days, people have very strong feelings about. Does that make it difficult? Can it be wearing for you to do your job in those situations, knowing that you're having to deal with people who are that emotional?
Farming is passionate. It's a lifestyle, John. It really is. You know, I think the farmers that I work with on a day-to-day basis are heavily involved in conservation. These are the landowners of those 13 million acres. This is their land. And, you know, the partners we work with and here in Indiana, we are national leaders in conservation, really pioneering the use of environmentally beneficial practices, things like cover crops, reduced tillage and nutrient management. Farmers, landowners want to take care of their ground and pass it on to the next generation. You know, the average age of an Indiana farmer today is 55.
A youngster.
In 2013, we actually, the Department of Ag honored 125 Hoosier Homestead farms in this state. And these are farms that have been within the same family for the past 100 years. And these farms, you know, generally stay within the family, but new generations take over management, and those new generations bring with them new ideas and innovations.
That's the other part, Kim, I'm going to throw this, sort of spin the question around, because the other reaction I hear, and this is not the first time we've talked about food or sustainability issues on this program, is that, you know, people push back against your position saying, well, wait a second, this is my farm, it's been in my family for generations, you know, who are you folks to tell me what I should do with my land, my animals? You know, how do you deal with that? How do you respond to it?
Sure. Well, I actually have heard from some folks who are in this very situation where they are generational farmers and have been confronted by getting big or get out. Mm-hmm. The economic pressure to adopt these industrial practices is huge because, as Laura mentioned, the market for selling locally is shrinking. The infrastructure is gone. So if you want to make a living now and support your family, you almost have to vertically integrate with a large outside national corporation. So the pressure to do that is overwhelming. And, you know, so of course, everybody has the right to do what they want with their land. But I think that they're, at least from folks that I've spoken with who feel that they really don't have a choice. And so it's not the Hoosier Environmental Council really telling them what to do. It's a large outside national interest that is coming in and telling them what to do.
Major market forces, basically.
Yep.
Marnell, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'm a psychologist, and I'm currently retired right now. I just recently retired, but I've, you know, talked with a lot of people, and I have real concerns about the fact that I was not raised there and born in this state. I've just lived, you know, in different places across the country. But when I've heard about the fact that they're still allowing crop dusting, you know, and that I've actually had somebody talk to me about how somebody who had crop dusting done near their house, you know, and they went over there, you know, the person who was doing, you know, driving the plane, you know, rode over where their horses were kept, and that started the horses, and then they were running inside, and the person came by again, and that people, you know, even though places are fined, you know, and stuff like that, it's like they still continue to operate. And when I heard that crop dusting was allowed here, I was actually truly amazed. I mean, to me, that's something from the past. You know, and we should be a little bit more aware of the fact that you don't just drive around, you know, spreading pesticides and herbicides into the air and have people who are deliberately not being careful, and then even though the company's fined, nothing happens, you know, because, you know, they can just pay the fine and it's like they can afford it, you know. And this is a major problem, you know, and I can't believe that it's even still allowed. I mean, it's archaic to me.
Marnell, I'm going to try to give them a chance to respond. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Well, Kim, I'll give you a shot.
Okay, great. I think that, you know, going off of what she said and your prior question to me about, mm-hmm. you know, people owning land and being told what to do with it, you know, when you make a product that's in our food supply, mm-hmm. You're going to be subject to public oversight and criticism or the reverse. And so I think to the extent that, you know, sustainable farming does good for a society and does good for the communities in which they operate, that's a great thing, and they're going to hear good things about it. To the extent that a large industrial facility comes into a community and decimates it, they're going to hear bad things about that as well. And then I'll close by just quickly saying that you know, the HEC forum is going to be delving into these issues in detail.
Give people the URL if they want to go real quickly. We've got about 30 seconds.
So. Okay. Go to hecweb.org, and on our homepage is information and a link to the registration.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank the three of you for joining me today. You have been listening to No Limits. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about the Spirit and Place Festival. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.